I'll call the order, the Committee of the Ways and Means. Today we have the budget report, the forecast. We're going to wait with approval of minutes. I think we're one short of a quorum right now, so we'll probably come back to that later. So at this point, I will turn it over to the presenters.
Thank you. Do I need a microphone? Let's scoot over. No, let's do this one. Let's just do this, and I'll move with you afterward. Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for this opportunity. With me, I have Dr. Columba Kiedis, the state economist, and Margaret Kelly, the budget director. What we'd like to do is run through the slide presentation. I think you have, do you have copies of it in front of you, or yes? Well, that's the book, but do they have copies of
it? Yeah, the slide deck is on the table here.
Yeah, the slide deck here, we should make sure. So we'll be walking through the slide deck primarily, which is starts off, it says 12-4 on the upper left picture of the Capitol in the front. So do they all have, yeah.
We have it. It's just printed on legal size, I think.
Oh, interesting. On the end of it. Good. I'll refer to the... I'll refer to the number then at the bottom of the page instead of my page number. Actually, let me.
I don't have
it. I do. I have one right here. It's easier to keep track that way. So, what we'd like to do is kind of run through the budget presentation and then obviously take questions and discuss what we need to talk about. The first slide, which is the bottom, is number two. Simply sets out the deficit for 2018, 2019, and 2020, 2021. So, as you now know, Dr. Columba Kiedis will talk about the economic outlook and the economic growth and how that's weakened since February. So I think one of the first things to remind everyone is that we're looking back to February. We're always talking about this forecast as it's changed from the February forecast. And we are now projecting $188 million deficit for this current biennium 2018-2019, and we are projecting a $586 million negative balance for 2020-2021. So let's go to the next slide, number three. This is what we call the look-back slide for the February forecast before and through the end of session. So what we really wanted to do with this slide was simply to indicate what had happened during the session. It's a little complicated because of the legislative appropriation, and I'll have a slide in just a moment to bring this estimate in line with the legislative appropriation issue we need to talk about. So you can see from this slide that the February we had $1.65 billion surplus that we were projecting for the 18-19 biennium, and then at the end of session we had made changes in revenue. We made changes in spending. You can see the amounts there, $657 million in revenue changes, and in the spending, $816 million. So we ended up with $163 million on the bottom line. This is not with the full appropriation for the legislature, so I'll mention that, as I mentioned, in just a moment. So the main thing here, I just wanted to show that we did make some significant changes in the surplus that we had projected back in February. And so the key then is when you turn the slide to number four, to see this is the new base. So the end of session now becomes the new base from what happened after February. And this is now where we put the November forecast on top of this new base. So Professor Columba Kiedis will talk about the $559 million change in revenues you see forecast in the change column, and Margaret Kelly will talk about the $398 million increase in spending that you see on the right side. But obviously, what we changed from $163 million on the bottom line at the end of session to $188 million in the deficit at this forecast. But that's not quite all the news. We need to flip to one more page, number five, and here's where we bring in the remaining legislative appropriation. So you may recall that the court ordered about $15 million of funding for the legislature during this last summer, and in order to reinstate the full appropriation to what it was back in May, we would have to add $114 million. So if you add the $114 million full appropriation for the legislature, that would bring the balance up to down to $302 million as a deficit. Obviously, we're going to have a February forecast that will come right at the beginning of session. So we'll have a different you're not hearing me?
I guess not.
That's a plus.
Is that better?
Yeah. No. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to take questions Representative. As he goes or whatever the preference is?
Actually, this is kind of a stopping point. What I wanted to do was sort of set the stage with the prior spending in this session and before we got to Dr. Klumbakidis and really clarify the legislative spending. So this is a good stopping point if you want to ask a few questions, or we can jump into Dr. Klumbakidis. It's up to you all.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
Your perspective as well.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask on the legislative funding, that 114. Now, I happen to be on LAC, and, you know, we made some passed a resolution there. So does this also, that 114, backfill the funds that were used from LAC under that resolution or not?
No, what this does is restore the original appropriation to $129 million, which is what was the original appropriation. So therefore, the spending that the legislature would do between now and the end of the biennium would be whatever you all decided to spend, and then clearly you would have money left over that you could then would carry forward. So you would the carry forward would be restored based on whatever spending was not accomplished in the session or the next 2 years, I mean.
Okay, that's what I wanted to find out. Thank you.
Proceed.
Yeah, I think now I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Klumbakidis to talk about the economic forecast. Yeah, let me move.
And I think I might have asked, forget to ask if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm Laura Klumbakidis, professor of applied economics at the University of Minnesota and the state economist. Shall I go ahead?
Yes, please.
Okay. So I'm going to start by talking a bit about the outlook for the U.S. economy and how that outlook has changed since we last prepared a forecast in February, and then I'm going to move to Minnesota's economy and then to the revenue, the changes in our revenue forecast. So the first slide shows the annual percentage change in real GDP, which is a measure of general economic growth. This is, the dark bars are the history for the United States, and then the light bars show the forecast, the November 17 forecast from IHS, the consulting firm that Minnesota uses for its macroeconomic forecast. So what you can see is that from the height of those gray bars off to the right is that the forecast of continued growth is expected to persist. So the United States expansion, the slow growth U.S. expansion, is expected to persist through our forecast period. There's no recession, which would be negative growth. There's no recession forecast in this outlook. Well into the ninth year of the U.S. expansion, the economic fundamentals remain good. The economy is continuing to add jobs, and consumer spending is continuing to be supported by improvements in income. However, the chart also illustrates some forecast risks. First, the rate of U.S. economic growth in this forecast from 2 to 2.5% is below the 3.1% average annual growth that we saw during the 20 years prior to the Great Recession. Slow growth is a risk. It's good. It's better than no growth, and it's better than negative. But slow growth is a risk because it makes the economy more vulnerable to shocks. There's less of a margin for error if some unexpected shock happens. And the current expansion is now in its ninth year, well beyond the average length of post-war expansions. The longer the cycle gets, the riskier the bet that that growth is going to continue. But as I said, the fundamentals remain good at this point. So on to the second slide. The second slide takes those gray bars that you saw in the first slide and compares them to the outlook we saw in February. So the dark bars here show IHS's November 2017 outlook for real GDP growth. And again, we're showing real GDP growth not because that's what we tax, that's what influences directly our tax revenues in Minnesota, but because it is a measure of, it shows you generally how the economy is growing overall, but it also, the comparison shows you how the outlook has changed overall between forecasts. So the dark bars show the November 17 outlook, the one that informs our current forecast, and the light bars show their February outlook. So as you can see from the chart, the outlook for U.S. economic growth has weakened since the February forecast. The economic data for the United States coming in this year have been mixed. There have been slowdowns in residential and business construction. but improvements in net exports and business equipment investment. In addition, earlier this year, so I think it was in July, IHS removed from their baseline outlook an assumption of federal fiscal stimulus in the form of individual income and corporate tax rate cuts and increased infrastructure spending. So that was not tax reform in the sense of a revenue neutral reform. It was simply a cut to individual rates and corporate rates. And that fiscal stimulus in their February outlook had been expected to support economic growth starting in 2018. The removal of the assumed fiscal stimulus is not the only reason that the outlook is lower, but it has helped lower the U.S. economic outlook relative to February. IHS's November 17 outlook was released on November 6th before the U.S. House and Senate passed their tax bills. So this outlook incorporates no change to U.S. tax policy relative to current law. So any economic effects of tax law changes emerging from the congressional reconciliation process are not reflected in this forecast and are a source of uncertainty. IHS has slightly lowered their forecast for real GDP growth in 17 from 2.3% in February's outlook to 2.2% in November. Lower forecasts for real consumer spending, so going forward, their forecast for real consumer spending growth is lower than it was in February, and that was brought down by the removal of the assumption of individual tax rate cuts. So real consumer spending has a lower forecast, and business capital purchases also has a lower forecast in this outlook, and that more than offsets an improvement in net exports. So this outlook has net exports growing faster than they were in the February outlook, but that's not enough to make up for the changes in consumer spending and business capital purchases. So that lowers the 2018 growth forecast from 2.7% in February to 2.5% now. The next slide shows one component of GDP, one component of personal income, which is U.S. wage and salary income. So this variable, U.S. wage and salary income, is all of the wage and salary income of all the employees in the United States. You add up the payrolls of all the employers in the country, and that's what this variable is. And the height of the bars shows how fast that variable, that total wage and salary income, is growing annually. So as long as the bars are above zero, that means that wage income is growing. And in this outlook, you can see from the dark bars that not only is wage and salary income growing, but it's growing at an accelerating rate in the dark bars, so from 2.9 to 3.4 to 4.4 to 5.0, so faster. But the outlook is lower than what they had, what IHS had in February. And that, the outlook is lower. IHS now assumes that a wage and salary income grows more slowly than they had assumed in February, primarily because data about actual wage income has come in lower than expected. So it's because the actuals have come in lower than expected. We now know that wage income grew much more slowly in 2016 than IHS had forecast and that others had forecast as well. 2.9% is what we know happened now, compared to 4.2% assumed in February. And it also appears that wage income has grown more slowly than expected so far this year. 2017 wage income is now expected to come in at 3.4% compared to the 4.8% they had assumed in February. And then the growth rates for 19 and 20 are also lowered by 0.3 percentage points relative to the prior forecast. Turning to Minnesota's economy on the next slide. So the next slide depicts the United States compared to Minnesota, looking just at the headline unemployment rate. So the light line is the U.S. unemployment rate, and the dark line is Minnesota's unemployment rate. The vertical gray bars show the U.S. recessions, and so the white space between the gray bars represent the recovery and expansion periods between recessions. So well into, again, the ninth year of this current U.S. economic expansion, Minnesota's steady economic performance and tight labor market continue. The state is currently, at the moment, adding jobs at the same rate as the nation, and that steady job growth has kept the unemployment rate low. Minnesota's unemployment rate currently stands, as you can see from the chart where I put in the low points of the previous two expansions, it currently stands at 3.1%, which is below the, the low points of the previous two expansions. It's well below the U.S. rate and the lowest we've seen in 17 years. When I say a tight labor market, what I mean is that we have high demand for labor and low unemployment. And regarding demand for labor, statewide, there are about as many job vacancies as there are unemployed job seekers across the state. And so together, that high demand for labor and low unemployment have supported growth in Minnesota wage and salary income. All year, average hourly wages, so it's a different variable than I was showing you on the chart, but average hourly wages is wages per hour on average. Average hourly wages by private sector employees in Minnesota have been growing faster than the comparable rate for U.S. workers, in some months as much as twice as fast. And all year, Minnesota's labor force participation rate has been ticking up. It reached 70.5% in October, 7.8 percentage points above the U.S. rate. That increased participation rate coincided with a period in the middle of the year when our employment growth was growing faster than the U.S. rate. So the increase in the participation rate is notable because Minnesota already had one of the highest participation rates among states, and it was above the U.S. rate. The next slide shows the forecast comparison for growth in Minnesota wage and salary income. So this is the analogous chart to the one I showed you for U.S. wage and salary income. Reminder, it's the sum of all the payrolls of all the employers in Minnesota. And this value grows, so it's bigger, if more people are working and they're working at the same average wage, average amount of income, or if you have the same number of people working and average wages per worker go up. Either way, this number goes up. And in our forecast, both of those things are growing. Employment is growing and wages per worker are growing. So in this forecast, we expect Minnesota's total wage income to grow at moderate rates of 4.3 to 4.7% per year over the forecast period. And just as with the U.S. chart, I wanted to remind you that as long as the bars are above zero, that means wages are growing, and they're growing at a faster pace from 16 to 17 and a little bit to 18 in this outlook. It does, however, illustrate slower growth in wage and salary income than we had anticipated in February. So echoing what I just told you about the U.S. wage growth, Minnesota's forecast change in wage growth here is primarily because actual wage income, as we observed it, has come in lower than expected. So in February, Minnesota wages had been forecast to grow 3.8% in 2016. We forecast Minnesota wages to grow 3.8% in 2016, and we now know that they grew one percentage point more slowly at 2.8%. And it also appears that wage income has grown more slowly than expected so far this year. 2017 wage income is now expected to be 4.3%, down from 4.7% in February, what we had expected in February. And then that, because 2016 is the base year for our forecast, The lower forecasts for 16 and 17 lower everything else a bit, too, the years going out. So turning to the next slide.
We have a question. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question about the wage growth and what's included with that. I know that as an employer myself, wage salary isn't always what they're working for when it comes to other benefits, i.e., vacation, personal family leave, health care benefits. Are you assuming this is just clean wages only, or are other benefits part of this driver to say that it's coming in lower, but are you also recognizing other benefits?
Ms. Quimbley-Bikides.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, this variable is only wages and salaries. It does include bonuses and stock options, but it doesn't include non-wage compensation like the health benefits and other benefits in kind that you might be talking about. So that's what this variable is, because we need to look at this variable in order to then use our income tax simulation model to estimate what people are going to pay in taxes. And so you're right that there's a piece of the economic story and a piece of the cost of labor story that is missing here, but the reason I present it this way is because this is what's going to influence our income tax.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just following on the same line, do you have any sense of why wages are growing slower than was expected?
Ms. Quimbley-Bikides.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if you can flip back, if you wouldn't mind, Margaret, to the GDP chart. So one thing to note about that slower, remember I said for both the United States and for Minnesota, we have this lower base in 16. Wages grew more slowly in 16 than expected. 2016 was a very low growth year for the United States. mean, it was perpetually, we were perpetually moving that bar down for 16. And if you remember a year ago, we were talking a lot about how tough things were in 16 for exports. The dollar was really high. Global growth was really slow. We had an election going on that was gathering a lot of people's attention, and it was just a slow growth year for the U.S. Remember, we had an oil price effect at the U.S. level, where oil and drilling, oil exploration and drilling activity was down, and that was all bringing GDP down. So I think that part of it is that 16 was just a low year, and that brought down the base of expectation going forward. There also may be some measurement anomalies in the data that we will find out about later. There were some calendar issues, things like that. But I would attribute this forecast change to the fact that the 16 base went down.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifier, I apologize for my voice. The on page 14 of the larger overall economic report, it shows a change in employment change by industry for the state of Minnesota. And it appears that some of the fastest growing sectors of job growth are those areas that may not have the highest wages, and likewise ones that are declining or slow in growth would be some of the higher income, higher paying jobs. Is my assumption correct? Is that part of the reason why we're seeing this reduction in the anticipation of wage growth, is that we're growing lower-paying jobs as opposed to higher-paying jobs?
Ms. Columbakidis.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, since this particular chart is showing the last 12 months of growth, I wouldn't put too much stock in the idea that we're just growing low-wage jobs. I mean, in the education and healthcare services area, there are a lot of really well-paying jobs. You're right, you've got leisure and hospitality and retail trade up there, but construction is up there too. And those are well-paying jobs, and that's been an area that's been adding jobs well throughout the expansion. Manufacturing is growing jobs as well. So I wouldn't say that at this point. No, if you look over, you know, over a longer period of time than the last year, then we do have significant growth, again, in that education and healthcare services area, but also professional and business services. So it's a valid observation, but I don't think that's the reason at this point.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Columbakidis. Related to Representative Liebling's question, why is Minnesota wage growth lagging the U.S. Average wage growth? Why are we behind them? I've been reading we're in like the lowest 10 in the nation. What would you attribute that to?
Ms. Columbakidis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if you look at the chart that we have right in front of you, the Minnesota one. So we have 2.8% wage growth. Oops, I wanted to go back right here. Yeah. So 16, we've got Minnesota wage growth at 2.8. 17, it's at 4.3. The U.S., that we have 16 is at 2.9, so that's slightly higher. But 2017 is 3.4. So we are forecasting for 17 and going forward that Minnesota wage growth is faster than the U.S. And our average wages, as I mentioned in my notes, our average hourly earnings have been growing faster than the U.S. by a lot this year. So earlier this year, our average hourly earnings were going up almost twice as fast as the U.S. So we do not have, unless I misunderstood the question, we don't have wage growth lagging the U.S. for Minnesota.
Representative Drazkowski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Doctor. I guess I'll have to go check again, but I've been reading differently elsewhere. So thank you.
Representative Carlson. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, being that these are percentages and Minnesota is perceived as a higher income state, we rank relatively high with our rankings of states, mm-hmm. would that not influence the percentage growth where you'd have some of the lower income states that would perhaps be growing faster because they're low-wage states to begin with?
Ms. Klubnik-Pikitas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, members of the committee, that is the correct observation, especially when looking at percentage change in personal income. So look at income in general. We have a high per capita personal income in Minnesota and high average personal income in Minnesota. And when you have been growing enough to get up to the top of that ranking or near the top of that ranking among states, then you should not expect lots of percentage change growth year to year, because the states that have the greater distance to go, they're starting at the bottom, they're more likely to have those big percentage changes. Another way to put it is we're starting at a high base, and so you shouldn't expect big jumps in income when you're starting from that high base.
That's my point, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Okay. So moving to the revenue slide. There we go. Thanks, Margaret. Those changes to the economic forecast have helped to bring down our forecast for tax revenues. Total general fund revenues for FY18-19 are now forecast, as you heard from the commissioner, to be $559 million less than the February 17 forecast adjusted for law changes. And so you heard the explanation about how we adjusted that left-hand column for law changes. So that's the end of session estimate. You can see that the forecast has been reduced for all of the major tax types. Only all other revenue, that category, has an increased forecast relative to the end of session estimate. I want to focus on the individual income tax number, which is, of course, the largest share of tax revenues. And it's also the largest change item in dollar amounts on this forecast. Individual income tax receipts in the current biennium are now forecast to be $461 million less than the prior estimate. That change is due to that lower forecast for wage income that you just saw, the 2017 to 2019 growth in wage income that I mentioned. And it's also importantly due to a decrease in our estimate of tax liability for 2016, the base year for this forecast. So we start with a base year, and then we grow off that base year. And we have to estimate tax liability for the base year because we don't know it yet. So the base year is 2016, and we had to estimate tax liability for 2016 in February, and we adjusted that that estimate for this forecast. And if you remember, at the close of fiscal year 17, we reported in July that while overall net tax revenues had come in very close to our forecast, overall we were pretty much on the money, the individual income tax in particular, net income tax revenue, was less than we had forecast. It came in at the end of fiscal year 17, it came in $257 million less than we had forecast. That shortfall, what came in fiscal year 17, was due to lower than expected net collections associated with tax year 16 returns, the base year for this forecast. So we now, thinking about what happened in tax year 16, as I mentioned, we now know that wage income grew more slowly in 16 than we had forecast in Minnesota and in the U.S. We also believe, but we won't know for sure until we see data from the 2016 returns, tax returns early next year, that some of that shortfall was due to lower than expected income from capital gains realizations. We have consequently lowered our forecast of growth in capital gains and some other forms of non-wage income. So that forecast change, lowering our expectation for growth in capital gains and some other forms of non-wage income, that's consistent with some other observations we've seen this year. So far this year, income tax payments have fallen short of the February forecast. And in particular, we have observed that our estimated tax payments have fallen short so far this year, not only short of our February forecast, but they're lower than they were a year ago. And that's an unusual situation for Minnesota, but it's a situation that other states are seeing as well. So let me remind you that estimated tax payments are prepayments on current year liability that taxpayers make when they have non-wage income. So throughout the course of the year, people are thinking, well, how much non-wage income am I going to get? Am I going to realize some capital gains? Am I going to take some business profits? I'm going to get interest and dividend income, and they prepay on their current year taxes. Well, those receipts have been lower than expected. And so lowering our expectation for capital gains income and some other forms of pound wage income is consistent with that observation. So what happens next after this forecast? Well, new information about income tax revenues that we expect to see between now and February will change the income tax forecast for the current biennium. In January, we expect to learn the actual tax liability for 2016, the year on which this forecast is based, which we are estimating at this point. Late January should bring new information about those final estimated payments. So people have made three estimated payments so far this year. We're going to see another one in December. So we will be looking at that December estimated payment to see, did it grow relative to last year? Is it going to make up some of the loss we've gotten so far this year? And we'll also see the final quarter withholding for 2017. Both of those things will provide some clarity about tax year 17 liability. And finally, in February, we will have the first information from a preliminary sample of income tax returns for 2016. That will tell us how capital gains grew in 2016. So let me conclude by drawing some your attention to some of the risks to this forecast. As you heard from the commissioner, there's significant uncertainty about U.S. fiscal policy, not only the tax bill, but also how Congress will address imminent deadlines to fund the government and raise the debt ceiling, as well as on trade and immigration policy. Some of that may be clarified in coming weeks, but some of it may persist. In this forecast, inflation is a risk. It's forecast to rise gradually from low levels, but when you institute fiscal stimulus in at a point in the business cycle where the country is at or near full employment, there's a risk of that sparking inflation, and that could cause the Fed to act in a way that slows the economy relative to what is expected. Capital gains realizations are the most volatile income source in our income tax, and they're also subject to taxpayers' choice about when to take those realizations. And the taxpayers are doing the same thing we are, watching Congress to figure out what their tax situation might be next year. And so they're trying to decide, do I take those profits now? Do I wait? And so even small changes in growth in something like capital gains, in assumed growth in capital gains, can cause big revenue swings and big changes in our forecast. And then I've already talked about the risk of that comes from a long, slow growth expansion. That concludes my remarks, and I can pass it on to the director.
We have a few questions. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Kolomakidis, I apologize if I missed this part, but getting back to the section that you had on the individual income tax for those that are prepaying, is it because these individuals are leaving the state of Minnesota, or do we have an idea of why? More details as far as why that number is lower.
Ms. Clinton. Ms. Clinton.
it's
you know, I practiced this before because it's a.
Who's the witness?
Yeah. Ms. Clinton-Bakitas. Sorry.
That's fine. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, members of the committee, we would have no way of knowing. All we see are the collections. So we don't know who they're coming from or who used to pay them and aren't paying them now. So we would have no way of knowing that. But the fact that we know that other states are seeing the same thing makes me think that it's not that. And also the Congressional Budget Office earlier this year reported that they were also seeing shortfalls in prepayments like this. So that's a U.S.-wide phenomenon. So. I don't know the answer, but there's some evidence that it's not just a Minnesota thing.
Representative Anderson.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chair and Dr. Kolomakidis. So of the other states, are they particular states? You know, is it like New York or so forth? Do you have a list by chance? And if you can get it to me offline, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't remember what states they were. We can try to sort that out.
Ms. Klebe-Bakitas, relative to that, I've always played by the 80-20 rule. 80% of my income comes from 20% of my customer base.
Mm-hmm.
Are we doing any stratification to see if indeed something is happening? Because with say, higher income bracket people not paying taxes, because the effect of one of those people leaving, if indeed that revenue stream comes from such a concentrated group, could be adversely affecting the entire revenue stream, and it would be good to know if something like that is going on.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what I recall from the last time we looked into this is that So this ratification and collecting lots of revenue from a small number of people, that's been a challenge for some of the states where there's a high concentration of, for instance, financial managers and people who work in investment banking. And, you know, one big person moves and that, you know, causes headlines. And that's not really the case for Minnesota because we're not a financial center. And if I remember correctly, the last time we looked at it, there was less persistence at the very top than you would might expect in a state where that is a financial center. And so, you know, somebody sells a business, and in that year they move up into the top, and then the next year they're not. And so, so it's less these concentrated in individual people. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, I guess what I was looking at is that there may not be a concentrated group of high-income individuals because of the progressivity of the income tax rates, mm-hmm. if indeed those people that are at the top of that rate scale are not here, would that be affecting it, and are we measuring that at all?
So what we do measure is we measure the volatility of the state tax system in order to try to capture the kinds of things that would cause problems for the state, cause revenues to be very volatile and move too much from year to year. And so we measure that once a year. We look at the volatility of the underlying income sources, and we look at the structure of the tax system. So we look at how the structure of the tax system might have changed to move toward a more volatile source or away from a more volatile source. And so we measure the individual volatility of the revenue sources, but then we also look at the volatility of the system as a whole. And then we make a recommendation for the budget reserve that's based on that volatility measure. So the idea here is that given the tax system that we have, what should the budget reserve be in order to manage the volatility that arises from that tax system? That's what we do.
Thank you. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did they report that? Okay. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Dr. Kolombakidis. As Chair Anderson cited, that one thing you said kind of caught my attention with how can the estimates really be lower? I mean, you're going based off your 2016 tax, and you set that up, and you'd better pay those, or if you mm-hmm. have more income than before, you're going to get a big penalty and mm-hmm. wrecks your day. So has that happened in the past where there's been that kind of fluctuation in the estimate?
Ms. Kolombakidis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so correct me if I've gotten the question wrong, but it sounds like you're asking if people are not paying as much estimated tax as they did last year, then they must be planning on a settle-up payment coming later in the year or on April 15th, and are we considering that possibility?
Right.
Is that what you're asking?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've certainly considered that possibility. At the moment, we have in the forecast that we expect fourth quarter estimated payments to grow from fourth quarter last year, even though the other quarters this year have not grown. And so we have in there that we do think some people are going to make a higher payment, but it's not as much as you might have thought if you were looking at, for instance, the fact that we thought capital gains came in short last year. You might think, well, all those gains are going to come in this year. And if that was really the case, then I think we would have seen those estimated payments be higher this year. And so trying to reconcile these different observations, what we've come down on is we've lowered our forecast for capital gains income, and we still do have some growth in the forecast for that fourth quarter estimated payment. If that doesn't come in, if we don't see that growth in the fourth quarter, then we're going to be rethinking this and think, well, maybe income really was lower than we had anticipated.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Doctor. Maybe this goes to Commissioner Franz, too. As I look through this, I'm very heartened by this forecast. I think this is a great forecast because the departments have really, I think, gone kind of lowball on this thing, and I actually think that's good. I'm not criticizing that at all because, you know, and you had to do some of the things you did, like with no CHIP funding. Why? Because under current law, it's not there. So I think that'll be there. Maybe not. We don't know that. where in the February forecast we took into account that there would be a federal tax bill or tax reform. We didn't do that this time, and that's hard to argue with because who knows what they're going to do out there. I mean, we've talked about uncertainty for some time. I think they'll get something done, but we don't know, and you can't account for it. Yeah, you did in February, and I understand why, because it was supposed to happen, and it hasn't happened, and so here we are. So I think that we're in a lot better shape than what is being said or not. I'm not questioning your numbers at all, because you have to take what you have in front of you into consideration, and I appreciate that. But I guess maybe to Commissioner Franz or Dr. Kolomoukidis, how do you see if there is a federal tax bill passed? And I know we don't like to speculate, but I think there will be, but not. And then we're going to be spending a lot of time together, because who knows how you do a tax conformity bill for what they're suggesting. And so I'm just writing out the next couple months, and I'm going to be up here talking to you and Commissioner Bowerly and others if that thing gets passed. But how? Let's say you had accounted for a tax bill being passed, kind of what you were seeing out there. What would that have done to the numbers?
To the tax buyers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we didn't do an alternative forecast with the tax bill in there. So I don't know what the revenue forecast would have been if a hypothetical version of one of these two bills had passed. What I can say is that, and this is just about GDP growth and not about revenues, but that when IHS produced their November forecast, they said we don't have an alternative scenario with the tax bill in there. But they said if the House bill would pass, they would anticipate that would raise real GDP growth by 0.2 to 0.3 percentage points in the year of implementation. So that would bring us up 0.2 to 0.3 percentage points of GDP growth, and probably in calendar year 18. But what I can't say is how that affects the Minnesota's revenues or even Minnesota's wages or any of those things.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative, let me just add one thing to that. I actually think I'm better off than I look, too, by the way. But on the tax bill, this is going to take a lot of work between now and when they pass this tax bill, and working with you and Senator Chamberlain and Commissioner Bowerly to see what that's going to do for Minnesota, too. So in addition to the economic outlook, the national economic outlook, we really have to take a look at what's going to occur specifically to Minnesota. What does conformity look like? It's going to be a complicated set of things, which is why I think we've all kind of come to some general agreement that the uncertainty around this is unusual timing here, with this tax bill literally being written while we're sitting here, provides some uncertainty that I think we'll have some clarity. But we're going to have a lot of tough questions to answer in the next several months, too, though. To your question.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Dr. Kolomoukidis or Commissioner Franz, I would think if there is something that passes out there with some of the deductions that they're looking at removing, that would put a lot more money into the state coffers, because we wouldn't be giving that tax break or whatever. And I would publicly like to thank Commissioner Franz and Governor Dayton for their press conference yesterday. I think it was very measured, very reasonable, and there's the political folks on both sides are going crazy, saying that, oh, the sky's falling, Western civilization will change as we know it, and all these things. But I really appreciate your approach and the governor's approach and being more measured, that, this is something that, I guess you're looking at the chairman that in 2011 as chair of the tax committee, and you we're very close. We had a $6.2 billion shortfall in November, so I'm not real big on November forecast. And we're going to work off the February forecast. And so we got through that. So when I saw this, I went, oh, wow, that's a rounding error. And I said that once on $70 million. I don't know if you remember in committee. And, oh, I got roasted on the House floor by, I think it was Representative Thiessen, I think it was, saying, you're calling $70 million a rounding error. Well, in $44 or $45 billion budget, it kind of is. And so, I've been talking to a lot of press the last day here, and a lot, oh, isn't this terrible? I said, what? I said, we can do this. This is not a tough one. But, I'd like to see higher numbers. That's fine. And I think the higher numbers will be there. And I just want to conclude my comments on, I'm very excited about the numbers, and I know the numbers will be better because I haven't paid my December estimate yet. That's coming in before the 15th, and these numbers will just skyrocket off the charts. That should take care of it. Yeah, they'll be paid on time.
to the other testifiers? I'm not sure what the response is there, but
I don't think there's a response.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll just anticipate the estimate coming in. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifiers, one of the, I guess, an area of speculation out there is the reason why we're seeing declining capital gains revenue is because people are just anticipating that there's going to be a lower tax rate in calendar year 18 and that they're waiting for January 2nd to realize those gains. If that theory is correct, is it going to be far enough away from the February forecast that we'll be able to account for some of those capital gains revenues in the February forecast?
Two of the testifiers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, of course, that was one of the bits of speculation about why capital gains came. It seems to have come in short at the federal level in 16. Is that taxpayers were anticipating a tax cut in 17, and so what are they doing now? Are they holding off again in anticipation of something in 18, or are some of them thinking I better take these profits before, I need to take the profits now? So in February, the pieces of information that we'll have that will help us adjust that forecast will be that we will see those estimated payments, including the representatives, and we will see, we'll have a, thanks to our friends at Revenue, Department of Revenue, we'll have a sample of 16 tax returns, and we'll see what capital gains growth was in 16 anyway, and then that can help us figure out what's sort of left out there. So I don't know what else is going to change between now and February. There could be other ways of thinking. You know, we may see some other observations that change our thinking, but all I can say at this point is that we will reforecast income tax, and we will reassess capital gains at that point with the information we have. But we still will not, it will still be a forecast for calendar year 18. We still will not have any information about that, and we won't really know what capital gains were for this year either.
So, Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, and to the testifier, so if whether there's an influx of capital gains revenue in January of 18 or not, really, that's not something that we should anticipate is going to have a significant impact on the February forecast in 18.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm not going to forecast the February forecast right now.
That's
all we could do to produce this one.
Right. My last question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
And to the testifiers, is there's been quite a bit of conversation at the federal level about eliminating SALT, the state and local tax deduction. Can you talk at a high level about what the potential impact or impact could be to Minnesota with now there's different proposals out there, but just in a general view, what the repeal of that would mean for Minnesota.
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think one of the things that we're examining right now is obviously in states where the state and local tax deduction is taken by most people, and in Minnesota, a large percentage of taxpayers do take that deduction. And to the extent that that's eliminated, it really depends on how much of that is offset by the enhanced individual deductions or exemptions that are replaced by. So the folks at the lower end of the income brackets, that exemption replacement will cover them fine. It'll be at the higher ends of the income spectrum where folks will see a higher tax where they will end up paying higher federal tax. So then we'll have to figure out what that really means for Minnesota as those people pay their tax and they're not able to deduct that on the Minnesota return. That income will really reduce, I think, some of the income that we're going to have in Minnesota. It may have a reverse effect, though. If in fact we eliminate some of these deductions, we may see, unless we conform at the state level that match up with the federal level, we could see a mismatch that I think we're going to have to work on trying to make sure that we don't. Because if we don't make the right kind of conforming changes, we could see income taxes actually going up in Minnesota. So, I mean, I don't know any much more than that. I haven't been able to look at these different proposals with much more in-depth analysis than that at this time.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's anything we would see us take action on in 2018, but it certainly appears like what's going to end up happening at the end of the day is you're going to see some cap or elimination of SALT on the deductibility of returns, and this is going to provide at a federal level a significant, just like I was concerned about us raising the top income tax bracket from 785 to 985, this is going to be the federal government basically doubling down on that tax and that revenue increase for Minnesotans. And it's going to provide a significant competitive disadvantage to the state of Minnesota, which is going to take an already high tax rate for a few individuals, and it's going to supersize it. And if this ends up happening at the federal level, we're going to have to realign our state tax code. We're just going to have no choice in that. Nothing is going to happen in 2018, but I would just hope that people are having conversations about that and planning for it, because for those who itemize and are in the 985 bracket, if SALT goes away or it's capped, it's going to provide a substantial increase in their tax liability, and we're going to have to address that.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who this would answer this, but I'm interested in the effect of inflation on the forecast. And I remember from last year when we heard the February forecast and we had the $1.65 billion projected surplus, I remember asking the question about what would inflation be, how much of that would be left if we were calculating in inflation, which we don't do under law, but I understand there's sort of an alternative calculation done. And at the time, if I remember right, it was that $1.1 billion of that 1.65 would, in fact, be eaten up by inflation. So the question I have is, what is the effect of inflation now on this current forecast, if that's been calculated?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director, and we do have an answer to that question in a forthcoming slide.
Okay.
If you want to hang on.
All right. Thank you.
Anything else? Okay. Well, Ms. Kelly, why don't we move on to you?
Great. So I am going to walk through the expenditure side of the forecast, and I will also talk about structural balance and inflationary impacts. So overall, as you can see on this table, spending has increased in the current biennium compared to the previous forecast by $389 million. And before I talk about the detail of where spending is up or down, I want to talk about how closing the books on fiscal year 17 is affecting our spending in fiscal year 18 and 19. So this particular forecast, a November forecast following the closing of the second year of a biennium, it's every fourth forecast, it captures carry forward spending. And while state law requires that all appropriations cancel at the end of the biennium, there are a few exceptions, your appropriations, for example. This forecast captures those exceptions, and typically carry forward is minor. But with this forecast, it is a part of the story because of its magnitude. When we closed the books on fiscal 17, $358 million of spending carried forward into the current biennium. $293 is reflected in the 18-19 spending in education, health and human services, and all under spending. And $65 million is in the 20 and 21 spending, 2021 biennium. So why so much carry forward this time around? Early last session, we passed the health insurance premium subsidy and transition of care programs, and we appropriated $327 million for a two-year period, fiscal years 17 and 18. $56 million was spent in fiscal 17 for premium assistance, and $270 million carried forward for spending in fiscal year 18. So when you carry money forward from one biennium to the next, it cancels itself out in the picture on the bottom line. It's money coming in and it's money going out. And the net effect on the bottom line is zero, so it's not contributing to the deficit in any way. But when you just look at the spending line, you see that half of the equation. And so that carry forward is driving up our spending number in the 18-19 biennium. Most of it you'll see in the $260 million line there under all other spending. So let's start at the top. Education spending is up by $121 million from end of session estimates. It's a 0.6% change on a $19 billion budget. usually we see education spending change one forecast to the next due to fluctuations in the number of the growth rate in the number of students. With this forecast, the number of students is virtually unchanged, and the increase is a result of special education funding. Special education is an expenditure-driven formula rather than a pupil-based formula like the general education formula. Spending on special education services by districts has increased at a faster rate than we had assumed in the February forecast. We have seen growth in the number of students receiving special education services in each of the past 4 years, as well as districts using resources to hire more staff to lower the child-to-staff ratios. As a result, the cost of special education is increasing, driving our forecast upward. This trend continues into the next biennium with this forecast. The next line, property tax.
Question. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Kelly. Just a couple of questions on those education numbers, and we've been trying to look into that. The special education formula, which is incredibly complicated, probably the most complicated of everything in education funding, I think, was changed a few years ago. And so it established basically a floor, sort of a hold harmless level for spending for schools using their 2016 numbers. So it looks to me like maybe schools spent perhaps a little more freely on their special ed costs in 2016 because to have that floor come up, because afterwards, I mean, that was impactful for looking at their spending caps. Is that something that you could comment on? And then the other question I had is, as those costs have gone up, we've seen a kind of a dramatic increase in fringe benefits and other things in the numbers for special education teachers. How much more light can you shed on those costs? Because my question is always, are we spending more on the students identified in special ed with an IEP per what they need, or is it more kids or more expensive levels of education per child that we're educating?
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, a couple of things. One, we did not see special education costs increase like we had thought we would after we had that law change. Though we thought that there would be a dramatic increase in spending in special education, we had assumed that in end of session and in our forecast, and we pulled money out following the law change because it didn't increase the way we thought. Districts didn't take advantage of the expenditure-driven formula like we thought. Now we are seeing expenditures go up, and we're thinking that it's because as we have put more money into the general education formula, districts have more resources, they're able to invest more into special education. And so where are they spending their money? It's a combination of growth in the number of students, which is driving up their costs, an increase in the number of staffing, so they're hiring more teachers and paraprofessionals, and there are increases in the per staff cost ratio, so the cost of teachers and paraprofessionals is going up. And I think those details are in our book under the expenditure section of our book.
Representative Bloom.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Ms. Kelly, do you know if this increase as a percentage of the special ed budget is comparable to other years? Is it a pretty dramatic increase compared to other years? How could we look at those numbers comparatively?
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's something I'd have to get back to you. I think my staff may have looked at that and may have put something together. If not, we can take a look at that. I know that the formula's intent was to ensure that the state continued to contribute a similar percentage year after year for special education so that that gap in funding didn't go down. And I think that we're accomplishing that, but I'm not sure to what extent.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Yes, if you might have some of that historical data you could send to us, that would be great.
Sure.
Thank you.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Ms. Kelly, you had talked a little bit about the premium assistance. I think it was 327? About $327 million. How much of that reverted back to the general fund? Because I know it wasn't all spent.
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, we 327 was appropriated, 56 was spent, and the balance was carried forward. There's a provision in the Health and Human Services bill I'm going to talk about in a minute that required MMB to certify if we were going to need the full amount. And we have certified that $99 million could cancel. So with this forecast, $99 million of that is reallocated for other spending in the Health and Human Services budget.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David. Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of concerned and wanting to know more. It sounds like the schools are given somewhat an open checkbook in special education. Can you help us better understand what we have for policy that allows this to happen?
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not the expert on the special education formula. Like Representative Loon said, it's a very complex formula. It is expenditure-based, but there is a cap. So it's not an open checkbook, but it allows, its intent was to allow the state's contribution for special education to grow year after year to ensure that the gap in terms of federal funding versus school district payments versus state payments, to ensure that that ratio remained relatively constant, that the state was paying its share.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Kelly, help us understand then why the budgeting isn't somehow tied to that cap, or where does the budget latch onto this number?
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, when we changed the formula in law, we had assumed that cap spending would grow at a relatively constant pace to stay in line with that cap. Initially, after the law was passed, it didn't grow the way we had thought. And so there was some room, and now we're catching up.
Representative Drazkowski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it seems to me that there's room for work here. This type of fluctuation and unanticipated expenditure is rather alarming to me. Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, a question for Director Kelly or maybe even Representative Loon. We heard from school districts for a long time about the crossover, and I think there were some adjustments made in recent years to try to reduce the crossover. School districts, school board members, superintendents, just to clarify what I'm asking about there, would say they were having to subsidize special ed because the costs weren't relative to what it really cost to the reimbursements weren't relative to what it really cost to deliver the program. So I thought we made some adjustments, but this crossover is still there. And could that not be driving why we see some increase in the special ed side of the ledger?
Ms. Kelly?
Therefore, a reduction in the crossover, but...
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe it is the crossover that this formula is trying to address, and I think we are trying to maintain the state's investment from a proportional perspective rather than a dollar perspective, if I'm not misspeaking.
Yeah, and maybe, I don't know if Representative Loon wants to chime in on that, but I know that crossover still remains an issue with school districts, but I'm not sure that it's quite as dramatic as it may have been a few years ago because of some of the changes. But
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson. Yes, I mean the cross-subsidy that exists for schools still exists. And, you know, the formula, again, with the change was trying to keep it so that it didn't continue to grow wider. But we do still continue to see greater numbers of children identified in special ed with an IEP and individual education plan. And then also some of the severity in terms of level of services that children need in some cases continues to escalate. So that combined with the fact that, you know, the federal government is a component of special education costs, and those costs have never... the money we receive have never kept up with the promise of a percentage of they're supposed to cover. Plus, Minnesota has additional requirements for special education above and beyond federal ones, and some states don't have that. So it's a complex combination of things. I mean, within the education formula, there's only a couple of things that have an automatic inflation factor in them, and one is special education. The other is adult basic education. But even with that, and with the reforms that were done and the growth cap that schools are under, we're still seeing special ed services, demand for those services outstrip funding.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Carlson.
I think initially when the comment was that it's a complex area, I fully agree. And I was just focusing on the crossover subsidy and if that wouldn't have been at least driving some of the costs. But apparently it's, like Representative Loon points out, there are other components within that that are driving some of the costs as well. Some of us will be meeting, I'm sure, in the next few weeks with school board members and superintendents, and I suspect that issue of the cross-subsidy, at least, will come up again because it's a continuing issue among the school districts.
Representative Graskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair, I struggle with this. It seems like the control function here, if you will, doesn't largely exist or is very weak. So,
the table.
There.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I don't know what we can do, Budget Director Kelly, about this, and Representative Loon and representatives. But this is an area we got to be able to have the budget track this and our projections when we're setting the budget, know where it's going. And a related question, Budget Director Kelly, are of this $121 million or $103 million that we're talking about, are these future liabilities already encumbered or are they projected?
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have seen cost growth already occur at the district level. And so this is a projection of how that will impact our budget going forward.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Budget Director Kelly, we could make some changes maybe tie some controls into this area to be able to restrict that area so that $103 million doesn't actually occur.
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, correct. I don't know how much of that is for fiscal year 18 versus fiscal year 19, but to the extent that you change funding for fiscal year 19, you would see funding go down.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair and Budget Director. Anything you could do, Budget Director, to get us more granularity about this and what our options would be in order to get better tracking and maybe get better control?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to provide Ms. additional Kelly. Information. I think it would behoove you to talk with the Commissioner of Education. I know this was a priority of the governor's to increase funding for special education.
A representative.
Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe just adding to a comment earlier, I think it has been pointed out that the federal government was supposed to commit 40% or did commit 40% to special education, and I can be corrected if I'm wrong, but I think the most that they have ever done since that 40% commitment was 17%.
Mr. Chair, unless there's more questions, I will move on to the property tax aids and credit line of the spending.
Yes, please do.
Slide, great. So property tax aids and credits are, spending is up $7 million compared to end of session. We have slower projected income growth. Dr. Kolomakidis spoke to that, along with property tax growth. And the two combined are driving increased spending for the homestead and renters property tax refunds. This is a $17 million increase, which is offset by decreases in the lowered spending in the targeted property tax refund and other aids to counties. The offsets grow in the next biennium where overall spending for tax aids and credits is lower in the forecast. So Health and Human Services spending increases only $13 million compared to the last forecast, one-tenth of 1%. This is a very small change for HHS, and it reflects offsetting spending changes that we typically don't see in a forecast. So I'm going to go through those in more detail on the next slide. So I'll come back to HHS. Debt service expenditures are lower in the current biennium due to lower interest rates during our fall bond sale and lower projections going forward. We continue to assume debt costs associated with an $800 million bonding bill for this session. The all other spending line is significantly higher than we normally see, $260 million. $10 million was a deposit into the Disaster Assistance Fund, which is based on a sufficiently positive balance at the close of fiscal 17 that allowed us to follow statute directing us to put $10 million into the disaster account if that happened. The balance of the $260 million is carry-forward spending, health insurance premium subsidy, and other appropriations across state agencies and the legislature. So let's look on the next slide at Health and Human Services spending increases, where there are some big changes that net out to a small change overall. So in HHS spending, the fluctuations in this area are typically the result of swings in our medical assistance or MA forecast and spending. We see that again in this forecast, along with some offsets that we typically don't see. So with this forecast, we're projecting lower than anticipated spending in long-term care programs, $249 million. This is a trend from prior forecasts continuing in this forecast, that recent enrollees in home and community-based services, waiver programs, specifically the Community Access Disability Inclusion or CADI waiver, are costing less than expected. So as new people come into the program, they're not as expensive as the people who had been in the program, lowering our costs overall. Similarly, lower average payments and lower enrollment in the elderly and disabled basic care program contribute to the savings as well. The MA and other savings are offset by several spending increases. First, this is a current law forecast, and the federal government has not yet appropriated funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP. And so we have assumed these costs will fall to the state, and we have increased MA spending by $178 million in fiscal years 18 and 19. CHIP has been around since 1997, and we have always seen a federal appropriation for the program prior to the start of the fiscal year. This is the first year there has not been a federal appropriation when the fiscal year has started. So we have forecasted according to that change in federal practice or federal law. So we also see a change, an offset here. The 2015 legislature established a statutory mechanism to transfer money from the general fund to the Health Care Access Fund, depending on the progress Minnesota is making to lower spending on certain chronic diseases. So on Monday, MDH released their report that state-administered spending on these conditions in 2014 was lower than projected by more than $50 million. And that triggered the transfer in law. Finally, the budget adopted last year included some contingent spending in Health and Human Services area of the budget, and I mentioned this a few minutes ago. Both items were contingent on savings in the health insurance premium subsidy program. And so we have certified with this forecast that MMB can cancel up to $99 million in that program, and those dollars are reallocated to first buy back a managed care rate reduction, and second to DHS operating costs. So the adopted budget assumed managed care rates would grow 0.5% less than our February forecast and made a contingent appropriation to DHS if they could not achieve the lower trend. And DHS has certified that it's not achievable. So $17 million in this biennium, $65 million next biennium from the $99 million are allocated to restoring that trend. And then the following is for DHS operations. So we have $248 million of savings offset by $261 million of cost increases in the Health and Human Services area. There aren't any more questions here. We can look to fiscal years 20 and 21.
You have a question, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Budget Director Kelly. First, just talking about the overall predictions for DHS for Medicaid programs has continuously been an issue, and it's a big one. Going back to 2011 with our big deficit, biggest coming in, we were way off on Medicaid spending predictions. And that impacted, we had a budget, we had a shutdown and a budget impasse that we had to solve in many areas that affected beyond just DHS. And some of those reductions in higher ed, for example, were never restored. We had to make those reductions outside of the contours of DHS. We paid back some of the K-12 and DHS cuts that we had to do. But some of the ones outside of that really got whacked because that number was way too far off. Now we see another $250 million that were just under anticipated. I've never seen one that's come in close to or over. We're always continuously conservative, and I understand the need to be conservative, but that has great impacts on our overall budget, and I'm just wondering how we're doing at trying to get a little closer within our predictions, and do you see that, and is there management structures in place that help us get closer?
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there's two answers to your question. One is the healthcare budget is a huge budget. And so even a small change in the cost of care or the average cost per enrollee or the number of enrollees is going to have a swing that has a sizable magnitude on our budget just because of the size of the budget. So small changes in this forecast is going to have an impact on the bottom line. But secondly, forecasting is an art and not a science. We continually talk with DHS before every forecast, after every forecast, and in between every forecast on their methodology and on their data and trying to refine it. And we, I believe, have seen improvements over my tenure as budget director in the forecast that they've done, and we continue to work on that every year. So.
Representative Dean.
And just as a follow-up to that and to particularly the relationship with the federal funding this year within Health and Human Services is a bigger deal than it normally would be because of the volatility and the unknowns that we have within CHIP funding that's projected to be out. Does this include any money that we're going to get paid back for helping out our individual health insurance market from the federal level?
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do have assumptions about the basic health plan and federal funding through the waiver for that. It does not impact the general fund, so you don't see it here, but we do have a health care access fund and a basic health plan fund statement out on our website that talks about the impact that the waiver will have on that fund. Both funds are showing a positive balance in 18, 19, and 20, and 21. But you're also correct, there are a lot of uncertainties at the federal level in terms of how federal policy will impact our Medicaid program.
Representative Dean.
And just lastly, could you go over again that $99 million in particular of how that money gets paid back and to which fund, please?
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, I believe that the law around the subsidy program was that once the program is all done and the books are closed, we would cancel any unspent funds to the reserve. Last session in the Health and Human Services bill, a provision was written into the bill that said MMB should certify with the November forecast how much could be canceled. And if it's up to $99 million, reallocate that amount for buying back the managed care trend reduction, rate reduction, and for DHS operations. And so with this forecast, we're certifying that $99 million could be canceled, but it's not falling to the bottom line. It's being reallocated for those two purposes of spending in the Health and Human Services area.
Representative.
And if I'm not, correct me if I'm wrong, but was that in the supplemental funding bill, the allocation to DHS operations, or was that in the omnibus bill, if you remember?
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, you got me there. I don't know which bill it was in.
Okay.
Please proceed.
Great. I'm going to move on to fiscal year 20 and 21. This table here shows structural balance, or imbalance, which is the case for this forecast. It compares the revenues that we collect in a biennium, so the revenues that are specific to that biennium with the spending obligations in that biennium, and that leads to the structural either balance or imbalance. You can see that we are projecting a negative balance in both biennia, $1.5 billion in 18-19, and improving to $337 million negative in 20 and 21. When you look at the growth in revenues from one biennium to the next compared to the growth in spending, we're seeing the annualized growth of revenues at 3.5% and spending at 2.2%. However, the spending number, as noted earlier, does not include inflation unless it's specified in law, like in the special education formula. So inflation is a little bit higher with this forecast, from 2.4 to 2.6%. And if we were to add inflation in the 20 and 21 spending estimates, that would be the value of about $1.3 billion. So I hope that answered your question, Representative Weaving. That ends my testimony. Unless there are other questions, I'll turn it back to Commissioner France.
Other questions? Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd like you to spend a few minutes talking about where do we go from here. I mean, one of the things that, as Chair Davis mentioned yesterday, Governor Dayton really wanted to make it clear that we have an issue to resolve. We obviously know that this forecast is preliminary in the sense of what we're going to have to work with for the next session. We do know that there'll be some answers coming down in the next 3 or 4 months. But we also know one of the things I've learned about the forecast is even though you may solve a couple of variables, a few more will pop up. But I think we all sort of agree that with the tax bill and a few other things, CHIP, for example, those are the kinds of things that might get resolved before this next our next session begins in February. So clearly the governor has decided to wait to make any budget recommendations until after the February forecast. Obviously, he's wanting to work together with the legislature to come up if we have a deficit. He would like that we work together to solve that. I mean, one of the things that we do have the reserve, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the reserve, which is a little over $1.6 billion right now. We call it a rainy day fund, and the question is this a rainy day or is this sort of a misty day, as I said yesterday? So the key is, we really want the rainy day fund to be there when we have serious economic downturns. That's sort of the goal of the reserve fund. And, you know, as we go through this economic recovery, we go more and more down that line. We know at some point we may reach that where we have a recession or a serious economic downturn. So we want to caution against using that reserve now. It may be part of the solution in session or may not. I think that's what the governor was talking about, the need for us to communicate about how do we go about solving the fundamental issues that we need to solve this next session and also deal with whatever the forecast shows us in February. We do have the resources to solve it, but I think the key is that we all realize that the economy is not in a downturn. The economy continues to grow, although more slowly. We know that, for example, our Minnesota unemployment rate is lower than the U.S. rate. But one of the things we've all talked about, you've all asked questions about, we have both upside and downside risk with this next with this forecast of what might happen in the next 3 months. So we just wanted to make sure that we're clear that we're here to think through these issues and to try to work on some There are issues, as I'm looking at Representative Baker, the opioid crisis issues. There are things that we need to do coming up that are clearly on the list, pension issues. So I look forward to working with all of you to think about ways that we can, A, solve the deficit, whatever that might be, in February, and, B, to figure out how we collectively can to resolve some other issues that we all want to get to. So with that, I more questions.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Franz. And you know, one of the items that was mentioned very briefly was a bonding proposal. And I'd like to ask just a few questions. You released a statement, I think, yesterday on bonding. And what is our debt capacity?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm sorry, I don't have the report with me. I do know we have, we're well within our debt guidelines. The question about debt capacity is, as we've talked in the past, a more complicated issue. I mean, I think one of the things that we have to decide is what part of our budget do we want to have go toward paying off our debt. One of the things we've tried to do with our debt capacity guidelines is to make sure that the debt that's outstanding and the debt that we have authorized stay within certain levels that keep it in check. And obviously, every year we're paying off some older loans and we're sending out new loans. So one of the things we've tried to do over the last few years is stay well within that debt, the debt guidelines. But the debt capacity is another issue. I think Chair Vogel and I have talked about that issue as well. So I think right now we're well within the debt guidelines, but we need to, I think, have further discussions about what our total debt capacity could be.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner Franz, just from my cursory look, it seemed like the capacity was maybe a couple billion dollars. I'm not proposing that be the amount of the bonding bill.
Yes, you are.
There would be too many heart attacks over here if I did. But what would you be recommending for a bonding bill this next year?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representatives, as you all know, I do not have an election certificate. But one of the things that we've talked about, that we're working on that bonding bill right now, as you, I know you worked really hard this last year as well on that, as well as the Senate has. I think one of the things we're looking to come up with is a plan that makes sense. And to be honest, we've been focusing a lot on asset preservation and maintaining some of the assets that we have. I think one of the things we're finding is that the state has a big footprint. The University of Minnesota, Minnesota State, and the state properties, there are a lot of buildings that need to be taken care of. This one is another example of a building that could use some improvements. So we're looking at what ways can we propose that. The governor will release his budget bonding bill on January 16th or earlier, and we're working on getting that ready. I can't really predict what he's going to do at this time. I do know that he feels strongly that we do need another strong bonding bill going forward, but we haven't really finalized what that amount is.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, I just wonder, are there any changes that you're contemplating in how the recommended amount is to be calculated?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, we made a change last year. One of the things that we faced last year was when we did not have a bonding bill in 2016, was a typical, we use a five-year average for the even year and the odd year to figure out what should the bonding assumption be. It was $800 million for the even years and $230 million for the odd years. So last year, we all agreed that simply wasn't going to work with the 2016 zero for the bonding bill. So at that point, we agreed to use 800 for 2017 as the assumption last November and 800 again for this year. I think, you know, assuming depending on what we do this next session, perhaps we can go back to that five-year average because it's worked fairly well. And I don't know what that average would be now given what happened in 2017, but the average going into 2016 was $800 million for the even year and $230 for the odd year, a little over $1 billion for the beginning. So I think that's something we need to address.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Franz. And that $800 million was the amount that, you know, I was contemplating we're possibly looking at. I'm glad that you are talking about asset preservation infrastructure, I think, you know, that needs to be a paramount concern, particularly when we consider that a lot of our infrastructure, our pipes, our wastewater systems, particularly in greater Minnesota, come out of the 1930s. And they are basically all wearing out at the same time. So we're facing a real crisis in our infrastructure in greater Minnesota because of our 1930s infrastructure.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I couldn't agree more.
Commissioner.
I think it's a real concern we need to address around the state.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Commissioner, just a quick question. You referenced, you know, and rightly so, that the governor's going to take sort of a measured approach and not propose anything real maybe drastic from this forecast and wait to see what we see in March, which I think is prudent. But any inkling on if there, again, is a deficit when we get that new forecast in March as to whether or not there will be a hands-off of the budget reserves? I personally hope that that will be the case, that we'll find other ways to deal with the deficit, especially given the strength of the current economy. But I just wondered if you had any notion at this point of how the governor may address that.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, he addressed that specifically yesterday and just really indicated he wasn't willing, doesn't want to take anything off the table at this point. But if you'll join with me and we get enough hands around that reserve, I think we can protect it. But I, you know, he just wanted to make sure that he didn't pre-decide anything until the forecast came out and he worked with the legislature to come up with a joint decision. But, you know, I think certainly I personally agree and would recommend to the governor and to all of you that we, if we have to use a reserve, we have to use it, but we should be very slow to use it and very cautious about our use of that.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I felt the need to bring this to the attention of the Finance Committee here, the Ways and Means. And earlier today, we had a select hearing on the technology and government responsiveness regarding the mess we have at MNLARS. And I will tell you, Commissioner, they will need your help to figure out how to get this thing turned around from a financial standpoint. Because as I mentioned today earlier, we don't need to probably spend more money on how much money they're already collecting from fees and folks that are paying tabs and title stuff. But what they do need to do is reallocate that pie to more to the deputy registers and less to DVS because of the huge change in the workload now with the new MNLARS system. So my request to you really is to actually reach out to your colleagues who are really underwater, and they are struggling to get a system to work. But it was clear to them that it was delivered to them that they have to come back to us with a idea of how we are going to correct this wrong. There's a lot of hurting counties and cities and private businesses, quite frankly, because of the extra expenses that have been incurred because of the local offices and the MNLARS mess. So I just only ask that you give them your assistance. They are going to need it. We don't know what the answer is yet, but they are clearly scrambling to try to figure out what to do because there's a lot of hurt out in all of Minnesota with this MNLARS issue. So that was more of a statement and really to give my colleagues here just a heads up that we're going to have to deal with that next year. So that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would simply like to thank Commissioner Franz, Dr. Klumbakidis, Ms. Kelly, for your presentation today. Very, very informative. Mr. Chairman, I would move the minutes of May 16th of 2017.
That is appreciated. Any discussion? If not, all in favor of the minutes as presented, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Carries. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I'll pass. I was going to comment a bit about the bonding numbers, but Representative Erdahl is no longer present, so thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I just wanted to highlight one thing. Within the budget, we have not accounted for funding the legislature. Said that if we had paid for the legislature, it would be $300 million deficit instead of $188. So I'm wondering, we also figure within the budget that we're passing a bonding bill of $800 million. So how do we pass a bill if we don't have the legislature funded in here?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think the key that the governor wanted to say, and he has the last couple of weeks, and certainly yesterday, was that he really supports signing a clean appropriation bill for the legislature. And I think now, obviously, what goes with that is a discussion about how do we fund not just the appropriation for the legislature, but also how do we fix the deficit or bonding bill or any other items that we want to agree with. So I think what it does is it forces us to come to an agreement about the numbers after we see in February what we have to work with. So he's clearly supportive of a clean appropriation. We'll just have to figure out how to do it in a way that balances the budget as part of the process.
And Representative Dean.
Yeah, and I'm glad to hear you say that because I've heard the governor's comments on fully funding the legislature so we can do our job and pass our bills, but I haven't seen anything concretely. So your comments on that are the first thing I've seen, I think, on the record with regard to funding the legislature. So could you talk about the governor's approach for exactly how we're going to do that?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members, we haven't really talked about the details. I think that's something we'd want to work out with the leadership and about how we would go through that process in the next several months as we lead up to session. So we don't have the particulars at this point.
Thank you.
Question I have, Commissioner, is, you know, as you go through the documents and you have the presentation today, it seems to be that maybe there's a little more uncertainty this time with some of the assumptions and so forth that were made. And also some of the variables, because they're rather large numbers. Now, putting you on the spot, but I do you have any thoughts as far as whether or not we'd want to revisit the law itself and how the projections are done and maybe having multiple scenarios or something like that so that we don't cause unnecessary heartburn relative to extraordinary things that seem to be happening this time that don't generally seem to have appeared in the past?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, that's a great question. I think one of the things this process has been working for a long time, which means it's either worked or not worked. It doesn't mean we shouldn't change it. But I think part of the difficulty in adding in scenarios is simply the amount of time that it would take. I will testify in great detail about how hard Dr. Klimakidis and her staff and Budget Director Kelly and her staff, the amount of hours and work they put in just to get this put together. To imagine putting some different scenarios on top of that, I think, is enough right now. Maybe it's just too soon to ask that question. But I think the key for us is that we need a benchmark. I mean, we need a benchmark. Whether we need a benchmark this particular year without a budget in January is kind of a question, I suppose. But we've looked at these forecasts to be benchmarks that are really providing a snapshot. And as a snapshot, they're always, you know, the next day the snapshot is not quite the same as it was the day we issued it. So I think we believe that these two per year and with these particular scenarios are enough. We do have the reserve policy and the analysis, the volatility of the reserve, of the revenue in terms of what the right reserve amount should be. We also do the forecast uncertainty report that you'll be doing in a couple of weeks. So we do have those that go with it. I do think that we would be really concerned about trying to add some more complexity and some more scenarios to that. It would be difficult to do.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, if not, we thank you for the presentation, the discussion, the better understanding, and we are adjourned.